Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our first finals edition for 2017 of the Weekend Wrap. And I tell you what, it couldn't have been a better weekend if we'd had scripted it. Joining me tonight is, as usual, Macca and Nikki. How are you going, guys?
Yeah, very good, thanks.
I'm feeling very happy right now.
Yeah, well, let's just not get ahead of ourselves, but it certainly couldn't have started any better, I don't think. Probably only Essendon beating Sydney might have capped it off. But anyway, let's get right into it. We've got a bit to talk about tonight. And before we get into our game, let's run through quickly the other weekend results. On Friday night, possibly the... Probably one of the worst finals I've ever seen, I reckon. Geelong versus Richmond. It was a shitful game. Richmond getting up with some Dustin Martin magic towards the end at 91-40, putting Richmond into one prelim and Geelong on the road to a straight sets defeat. You guys watch that game?
Yeah, I did watch it. Yeah, I did watch it. And I thought we learned something from the game in the sense that... Geelong aren't, away from the Pussycat Fortress, they're not that good, and they definitely aren't going to be the premiers this year. In fact, they will go out in straight sets. So they won't be able to hold off Sydney, in my opinion. In fact, Sydney have done them over, I heard tonight, five times in the last six meetings by 50-odd points. So I think it'll be bye-bye Pussycats.
But most of those games are either at Simmons, or they're at the SCG, they're not at the MCG, which Sydney have struggled with lately. But just watching Geelong, I mean, people are raving about Richmond winning by 56 points. Geelong gave up in that last quarter. And that's when Richmond could finally go, oh, do we kind of have some forward movement that we could practice? Because we haven't been doing it for the rest of the game. It was putrid on both sides.
I don't think the Cats had any answers, to be honest. Their selection was poor. Leaving out Daniel Menzel when they really needed someone to kick a few goals was a bit ridiculous. And, yes, they wanted to apply some forward pressure. But an interesting stat that I heard was that prior to the game, Geelong were actually second in the competition for tackles inside forward 50. So I don't know where that deficiency was coming from that Chris Scott was trying to fix, but they could have done with Menzel up forward.
Totally agree. Yeah. And selection in these final games is very, very important, as we'll discuss a little bit later. But the other thing too is the fact is... Dangerfield, they didn't really tag him, but they did make sure that he got very few kicks where he wasn't under pressure. And his kicking efficiency was 30-something percent. I mean, bloody hopeless at this level. I mean, I can't imagine, it's hard to imagine a Brownlow medal winner kicking at 30-something percent, but he did. And the other bloke, Joel Selwood, well, he obviously played with a shot in his ankle. I mean, Chris Scott was saying you can't injected and stone his appendix. Well, he could have if he'd got it before the hospital cat got it. Silver, he wasn't much chop either. So they didn't get out of those two guys what they normally rely upon, and it does show they are actually a very one-trick pony.
But his disposal, his kicking efficiency is not a surprise to us, Macca, because everybody talks about how he actually has a decent disposal efficiency, but that's his short handballs. If you actually extract out just his kicks, they are not good, and we know that. Occasionally he'll have some nice ones.
It's the reason why we let him go for a first-round draft pick and Dean Gore. Because we didn't really value him that much because of his disposal efficiency, Nikki. look, Danger potentially cost us a grand final spot a few years ago in that Hawthorne prelim when he tried to take it all on himself. And there was a lot of that going on in the game against Richmond as well, trying to do too much by himself. And there's one thing to be confident in your ability, but there's another thing to remember that you're playing a team sport. And you compare what he does to what Tex Walker does or an Eddie Betts in terms of bringing other players into the game, and you can see very quickly what's more valuable. And It's an area of Dangerfield's game that is severely lacking, and something that I think he needs to take on board, that there's more value in bringing your teammates into it rather than try to do it off your own boot.
Finals are about teamwork. It's the best team that wins, not an individual. And Danger is all about an individual. And you had the perfect example that you didn't name then, Phoenix, that actually played in the game that night. And it's somebody that we talked about after the round one Richmond game, where Martin, how he's actually changed his game. He is so much more team orientated now. And he was a major difference last night because he was team.
And his disposal was excellent. I mean, he set up several goals.
Well, and that's the difference, isn't it? Because, like, Martin certainly picked him up and put him on his back in the last there with some excellent one-on-one or 50-50 contest wins. But it was what he did with the ball after that that was the real killer blow for Geelong. He picked out teammates. And, you know, he wasn't trying to take three or four bounces down the wing and kick a goal himself. He's just simply winning the ball and kicking to the right positions. And, you know, there's no doubt that without Martin, Richmond is just another average team. With Martin, they pose a bit of a threat just because he's taken his game to such a high level. And he is a proven match winner.
The one thing I think one thing, Craig, you've got to give Richmond credit for, though, is effort. I mean, that I thought as a team, they played very, very desperately right through the whole game. And that if you play like that, you've always got a chance.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, just on the Martin, but also towards the Dangerfield Selwood thing. So after our game on Thursday night, Fox had Jordan Lewis in as one of the little panel of experts discussing the game afterwards. And they asked him about, as somebody who's played recently against Geelong, who do you tag, Selwood or Dangerfield? And he didn't want to answer it. Eddie pushed him and finally got an answer, and he said Selwood. And the others looked kind of shocked. And he said, well, Dangerfield's most damaging when he gets on the outside and he gets a clean possession. Selwood's the one that gives it to him, so you stop Selwood. I mean, we've known that, but it was kind of funny watching those so-called experts thinking, well, this is new information.
Well, and it stands to reason. I mean, when Danger goes in and gets his own ball, he tends to burn it. When he receives or when he's playing up forward, he tends to use the ball more effectively. But he's so intent when he's in and under to get the ball out, stand up and attack or break free and then just burst away that he forgets then, or he hasn't got the capacity then to pick out a good target. And the ball invariably gets, you know, bottled up in another stoppage or it comes back over his head. So it's not an unsurprising observation from Lewis. Do we think Geelong are any chance next week?
Zero.
No,
I don't think so either. I don't think so either.
On that performance, if that's as much as they can provide, and they can probably provide a little bit more with mental in there, as you say, that attack suffered badly by not having the dangerous mental in there. On what we saw, they couldn't possibly win. But, you know, footy's a funny game. But I'll say definitely Sydney to win and bye-bye Cats. And I think Richmond will win their prelim no matter who, because they've got the very easy side of the draw.
Don't jump the gun. speaking of Sydney, we'll move on to Saturday's game. And I thought Essendon might just trouble Sydney a little bit, but it wasn't the case. And Sydney towed them up 121-56. I only watched half of this game. It was pretty boring. And Sydney romp in to a final against Geelong to get into a prelim now.
Too easy, wasn't it? Essendon gave a yelp for 2 minutes or 3 minutes of the game. That was about all it was. And then after that, Sydney, well, the only pain they really suffered after that was a headache trying to count the number of goals they kicked. It was just an absolute shellacking, really. And I didn't enjoy the game at all, really, to be quite honest.
They had a training run. They were literally witches' hats. And although one thing I was kind of pleased to see, I only saw the second half, and even then it was just every so often I'd look up and go, oh, they're still playing, was Rampy finally being penalised for the hanging on that he does.
Yeah, that was interesting.
He does plenty of it too, Nikki. You are quite right.
Well, he did it against Walker in our game, and I thought Tech should have had so many frees, and it was so blatant. So I wonder whether we had a few words, and they've been looking at him since.
Well, you know, it was Joey Danaher, and Joey gets a fair run. So it'll be interesting to see if that. You know, the other thing that Rampy does is tunnel. He gets underneath the forward quite often, and that's quite dangerous. So.
Absolutely. That's a very good point you picked up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Danaher does get away with a lot that he shouldn't. Yeah.
No, you're talking about Rampy.
I'm talking about Rampy tunnelling.
Yeah, you know, he does.
Yeah, he does. A couple of the Sydney boys do, actually. They push right in. When the forward jumps into the air, they push right in underneath him. It's an interesting tactic. Tom Richards used to do it as well when he was playing. But look, the upshot is that Sydney are going to be the cause of Chris Scott's demise again. Chris Scott doesn't have a very happy finals record since winning his maiden grand final in his first year. So 2-7 now, and Scorpus made a really good point, I think, which was sort of lost beneath big footy rubbish on the main board, saying that it's actually to Geelong's disadvantage, I believe, that I agree with him. This is what Scorpus said. To Geelong's disadvantage that they have such a great home ground advantage, because it actually, I think, may inflate their own opinion of where they're at, because it is such a massive home ground advantage. And as a consequence, it's elevated them probably higher on the ladder than what they deserve to be, and it probably made them think that they were perhaps better than they are.
I think it's quite an astute point, and I wouldn't disagree what Scorpus has proposed there.
I also found out something else I didn't know was Lee Matthews was actually asked early on about the Scott brothers, and his comment was that Brad can coach but Chris can't.
Yeah, but on what basis is he actually making that comment? Because
I think they actually did some coaching things whilst they were still playing, so it was his observation as their coach. And kind of preparing them to life after football and heading into the coaching ranks, that what he could see was that one had the ability and the other not so much.
My observation is that Brad is less articulate and more emotional, whereas Chris is more articulate and better able to contain himself in the media spotlight. He's very well spoken. Whether any of that equates to being able to coach, though.
Yep.
Who knows?
All I actually want from the Sydney Cats game, is for Catman to have another little tanty, because that was delightful.
Apparently, yeah, 60 years old, that bloke.
And the amount of face paint, I actually used to do face painting on people, and I know how itchy that stuff is. He's got a lot on there, which is, I mean, it's quite detailed, but that would be so uncomfortable to sit in. And yeah, it's really warm.
I'll tell you what, Nikki, that tan is only about 50% of what the Scott brothers do. I was going to say, one of the things I do like watching on match day is the Scott brothers doing their arms wide spread and they're going, what, as if to say, how could that be? You know, when it's obvious to everybody else, but they're quite an amusing couple, really.
We'll talk a little bit about coaches' body language when we get to our game, because I thought some of the footage of Leon Cameron throughout the game was quite interesting. But before we talk about our game, let's talk about the second most enjoyable game of the weekend, and it was a historic match for a number of reasons, but mainly it's the first time a team's been beaten after the siren in overtime, and I would suggest that it's the first time that a side's been beaten after being 13 points up with 5 minutes of overtime plus about 20 seconds to go. West Coast getting up at the death with a Luke Shuey kick after the siren, 78-76, and the tears were delicious.
I have to say that for one stupid moment, I felt sorry for the Port supporters.
Come on.
Hang on, I haven't finished yet. I just had for one moment. Then I remembered all the shit they've given me over the years, and I thought, you bastards, it's your turn. And also, I had backed West Coast at 275, so I was quite happy to see the result go that way. It was an interesting game to watch, but I do agree with the chairman of Port Adelaide that he's querying the selection of the side. And as I said off air before we started, when you look at the last line of the West Coast Eagles in their forward line, when you've got Kennedy, you've got Darling, you've got Petrie, and you've got three kids standing, and I'm saying to yourself, well, you're really asking for trouble. And that's what happened in the first quarter. They got a four-goal break, and those guys were very significant in that, in getting that break. And I think, you know, that thereafter, Port was struggling.
Oh, look, Macca, they didn't take advantage of a massive differential in forward 50 entries, particularly in the third quarter. They could have iced that game quite comfortably. But I actually think it was terribly poor form from David Koch to come out a couple of hours after a loss like that and basically tell the players they can piss off. Like the players had just slogged their guts out for 140 minutes. You know, and their faults and flaws and mistakes notwithstanding, none of them didn't not try. And for Koshy to come out and say that so soon after the match, and in the face of his coach Hinkley backing the players and their effort, there's a real fracture at that club at the moment, a real disconnect. And I thought David Koch was completely and utterly out of line.
I totally agree with that too. I'm just saying what he said is something that I do agree with. I was very surprised that Port Adelaide went down that path and left a couple of their senior defenders out. But having said that, you're totally right that this isn't the first time Koch has done it either. Really, it makes a fool of the coach and the match committees and all the rest of it. They are the type of things that if he thought that, I can forgive him for thinking that. He should be talking that to the coach and to the panels and other people behind closed doors, not through the media. And unfortunately, Koch makes it all about himself.
Always makes it about himself, Macca. He's a media whore, and there's no disputing or denying that he's done some good things for that club financially. But whoever thought it was a good idea to put him in front of a microphone and allow him to say that sort of rubbish after the game, if I was a player at Port Adelaide, I wouldn't have even listened to it. I would have just dismissed it. That being said, I think it also indicates, given what Ken Hinkley said in the press conference afterwards about complaining about this town and the people in this town, that obviously includes Port supporters, and him being sick of people bagging the club for, you know, overpaying Dixon or whatever. Obviously, Ken has forgotten to take his cup of concrete as well, and I don't think Ken will be coaching at Port next season.
I thought that was a big boo-boo too, because he really was having a... he's really not talking about Crow support. He's really having a crack in his own support.
Exactly.
There. And...
And
yeah,
the media that's pro his team.
Yeah, very much so. And when you think about it, the two of them made a nice cock-up after the game of their various comments. And two nice guys. But I think that you might be right, but I think I'd get rid of Koch before I got rid of Hinkley, although I don't think Hinkley will ever lead a team to a premiership.
Well, I'll tell you the reason why I'd get rid of Hinkley tomorrow, Macca, and that is because they were 13 points up with 5 minutes of overtime to go effectively, you know, plus a couple of seconds in that first period. Why didn't he just shut the game down? That game was so open in that second period of overtime. They allowed West Coast space. They allowed West Coast to move the ball, and Hinkley should have had everyone around the ball. He should have made the ground as small as he possibly could. It was only 5 minutes that they had to maintain that 13-point lead. West Coast are old. They're slow. They would have been out on their feet just as much as the Port boys were, and all he had to do was shut it down. And yet we had situations where West Coast had open forward lines. We had situations where Wingard was playing on after a free kick when he should have just let Travis Boak go back and ice the clock a bit. And when Wingard did have the ball, he just picked out bloody Jeremy McGovern. They lack composure on the ground, and they lack composure in the coach's box. And I think in the fullness of time, when people's emotions die down about the contentious free and actually have a look at what happened in that overtime situation.
Port have so much to blame because there's also Ryder tapping towards the West Coast goal.
That's right.
Gray setting up behind him instead of in front of him towards the boundary line to push it over the boundary line.
Yep.
And take some more time off the clock.
Yep.
It was just stupid.
Yeah, that ball should have lived in the centre square for that second period. It should not have been. They should have played rugby in that second half of that overtime period. And to continue to play football and to try and, for whatever reason, try and build on a 13-point lead with 5 minutes to go, there was no purpose. There was no reason to do it. You know, notwithstanding that they had an ineffective forward line, they had all those forward 50 entries in the second half and couldn't convert. That game was theirs to win, and they handed it to West Coast on a platter.
Yeah, I mean, their single game plan is get it forward and score goals. We just have to keep getting it forward, score goals, get it forward, score goals. They don't, as you said, take the time off the clock. They don't ice it. They don't push it out wide. They don't congest. They want to get it out. And as PJ Crowe said in the chat, they want to play like heroes.
Yeah, well, I couldn't. Yeah, you know, they don't really have a proper game plan, Nikki. Apart from the fact is that when they apparently one of their aims is to try, if you can't get it to a man up forward, kick it to the right forward pocket so that Robbie Gray or somebody can snap a goal from the throw-in when it goes out of bounds. But I just watch them every week, and I never can work out what their game plan is. Maybe I'm slow, but I just can't see it.
Well, it doesn't seem to be they keep going on about the Port Adelaide way, but if you're asked to actually define what the Port Adelaide way of playing football is, it's not really distinguishable by watching them. You know, their forward entries are very predictable. They, like you say, Macca, they always go wide, and they're either looking for a stoppage or an out of bounds or whatever, and to reset. But they don't, there just doesn't seem to be any purpose or any sort of pattern to what they're doing. It's like it's all based on individual efforts, Port Adelaide, and they're all, you know, hoping that Robbie gets the ball, or hoping that Travis gets the ball, or Chad or Charlie takes a mark. And you know, there's no pattern. There's no even spread of contributors. And you know, we'll talk about our game in a second and how two opposing games in terms of structure and game plan and how to use the clock and how to play under the right circumstances in certain periods of the game. And Port should have won that game. There's no question about it. If I was a Port supporter, I'd be absolutely livid because the coaching staff and the players didn't appear to know what to do at certain points in the game.
Yeah, and the other thing too, which is I've had several Port supporters cry on my shoulder about, and it's a wrong shoulder to cry upon because it doesn't help them very much, is that Charlie Dixon, who was a hero of sorts for three quarters of the game, those two pathetic weak shots he had when he could have iced the game for them. And, you know, big Charlie, big man, you'd have to think he froze because he just pushed it out to the right. And as we know, Phoenix, that's when you don't bring the leg through properly.
Yep.
And you're just poking at the ball, and she goes to the right.
It's experience and calmness, which are two things that Charlie lacks, which Shuey displayed the opposite of. But whilst everybody's hailing Shuey for that kick after the siren, which was immense, the amount of pressure that is on there, at least some of them have, but they kind of don't keep talking it up, is Eric McKenzie. In that bit, just before full-time ended, making sure, putting his body completely on the line.
Yeah, just about knocked over the point post.
Yep, to make sure that was not a point, that they didn't get a score.
That was brilliant.
Smart footballer who knows the score, who's pretty sure there's very, very limited time left, and I'm not going to give them a free hit.
Yeah, no, experience. It was desperation.
Smart.
One of the smartest things I've seen on a field, because I couldn't see any way out for him when he first took the ball.
Anyway, we've spent 25 minutes talking about other teams and other games, so I think we've given them their fair due, and we could carry on about Port, but I reckon we might leave that to Tuesday night when we've got probably about an hour cockwomble segment to go through.
I think Pete's going to enjoy talking about Port.
I think you're right. But let's move on to our game, and it was the opener for the finals week one, and as we all hoped and some of us expected, Adelaide got up quite comfortably, really, 84-48 after taking a commanding lead at halftime. We led for the majority of the match. We led by as much as 45 points halfway through the third quarter, and to be honest with you, we didn't really ever look like losing that match from about halfway through the second. What did you guys think?
What I really loved about the game was our hard edge, and that started even before the game started when we lined up. And when they lined up, I said, Mrs. have a look at that. It looks like we're ready to do the bloody haka. And, you know, that with the legs spread and the arms spread and a steely resolve on the face and staring at the opposition, look, I don't know whether it affected the game or whether it didn't affect the game.
But yeah, it did.
But I loved the image of it. I just loved the image of it. It said, we are a tough bloody team and we're coming after you. And that's how they played.
Now, what it was, Macca, was that when the anthem ended, they stayed in that position. They did not move. They made GWS retreat. They made them break. They didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, you've taken away GWS's focus, kind of bit at the start. There's this team that's looking, and when they pan down that line, you look at Heath Shaw on the very end when the camera gets to him. He's looking up in the crowd. He's refusing to look across. Jeremy Cameron's got a nervous little titter. He was actually the one who broke first. He didn't quite know what to do. But I think Laird's was on AA who talked about it and said it was actually Tex's idea. But and what it was more to do about was not so much bullying GWS, which is partly what, you know, what the effect of it was, but it was more about we've had issues with our starts.
Yeah.
And this is a way to get the team together. This is a final. This is how we need to start. We are together.
I think that was the key. It was more about our own mindset than any sort of intimidation towards GWS. Although I must admit that it was funny when GWS kind of half broke and then saw that we weren't moving and sort of thought, well, hang on, is there more? And went back into formation, and then Leon Cameron's looking around, and they were thrown. Not that I think that it had any impact on them, but I think, as you rightly point out, Nikki, I think it was about our mindset, and we certainly started better than we have done for quite some time.
I mean, we then followed it on with bullying them at the body, which is what we did in the first game of the season as well. And that's what they're very susceptible to.
Yep.
So this was the mental bullying, which we then followed on.
Yeah, we had a lovely hard edge to our game. And I mean, even blokes like David Mackay, reckless with the body and diving in very hard and tackling hard. I just thought that was absolutely fantastic, the attitude of the players and the way they played. And as Phoenix said before, with the lack of teamwork possibly at Port Adelaide and looking at Adelaide, there was a football team. We played as a team and I loved it. I thought we were very, very good.
It'll be interesting to see PJ Crows on the chat ask, will we do it again? It'll be interesting to see if we do it again, because there's probably two schools of thought there now, that you do it again and the other team's ready for it and they, you know, take the piss, or it doesn't have any impact, or, you know, maybe we don't do it again. I don't think even the players probably know at this stage whether they'll do it again, but it'll be interesting to see what they do in the prelim. Let's look at some head-to-head stats, because when I was going through and analysing this game today, it was quite interesting to have a look at the stats and compare it to how the game played out, and I'm really keen to have this discussion with you guys as to where we may have won or where GWS may have lost the game, because the stats were actually quite even. GWS had more disposals than us, 354 to 340, although our kick-to-handball ratio was much better than theirs. We kicked the ball nearly 2-1, whereas GWS were almost 1-1 kicks and handballs. We took more marks as a consequence, 77 to 63, but they out-tackled us 110 to 88. So people saying that they weren't cracking in, they were certainly cracking in. Hit-outs 45 to 38, I thought Source did an amazing job against Mumford, and whilst Mumford might have got the cherries in terms of actual hit-outs, I thought Source's impact on the game was far in excess of Mumford's. The frees were relatively even, 24 to 19. I didn't feel as if the umpiring had any real impact on the game. Look, our scoring shots conversions were back down to our usual level, around 14 disposals per scoring shot. It's been up in the high teens, even the low 20s over the last couple of weeks. So getting it back down under 15 disposals per scoring shot was key for us. GWS up around 20. Clearances were the same, 42 each. They won the centre clearances 12 to 8. We won the stoppage clearances 34-30. I'll talk a little bit about that as a possible key in a moment. Rebound 50s, 40 to 34 our way, 52 each inside 50s. So same inside 50s, but we were more inclined to get a scoring shot away when we went inside 2.17 inside 50s per scoring shot to 2.89, and almost half the inside 50s per goal, 4.3 to 8.6. So we're more efficient inside 50 when we got it in there. Of the rest, contested posies was even, 159 to 160. Uncontested, 181 to 199 in GWS's favour. Disposal efficiency was almost the same, 69%. Contested marks was almost the same, 10 to 9. 11 marks inside 50 to 10 our way, 42 clearances each, as I mentioned before. Even that random 1%ers stat was even. There's not a lot of difference statistically between the two sides. So before I have put forward my opinion, I'm interested. Pat Smacker, you first, and then Nicky, you have a crack.
Well, I think the difference is the way you play once you've got the ball and what you intend to do with the ball and the way that the roles that the players play. Our team, there are certain players that play different roles. You know, for example, Lynch is one, each of the forward line has got a different role to play. And it creates a lot more opportunities and scoring opportunities. And our back line has got a bit of a rotating structure to cover for each other. And I'm not saying that GWS don't have these things as well, but ours worked a lot better than theirs did, and I think that's the difference between it. And we did have a very hard edge to our game. We definitely had the harder edge out of the two teams, and I would say that we put them under a lot more pressure. That's why some of those handballs came into being too, because of the pressure that we put the players under. So, I just thought that the difference really in the between the two teams was I thought we had a better structure that worked.
Where'd you go, Macca?
Well,
he's died.
Oh, no, wait, that's it.
No, you sort of faded out there towards the end.
Yeah, so we missed the last bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I thought the two main differences were the structure that we used and that we stuck to, even after Smith got injured, and also the hardness we had in our approach to the ball and to them.
For me, when you're looking specifically about those tackles, it's that you look in that third quarter when they managed to finally start to try and they were trying to lock in the ball, And so there was a bit of the rolling scrum. Now, we were the ones that were tapping on the balls. We were the ones that were getting to the ball first and moving it around. So that's where they're getting their effective tackle numbers up in the forward half with that. But we were still, we couldn't get it out fully, but there was, we were in control in a way in that bit. So I think that explains a number of those numbers there for the tackles count. The way we were playing and the way we were forcing them to play, they got more possessions because they would get the ball and have to go sideways and have to go back. They weren't getting their long kicks, or when they were finally doing a long kick, it was under pressure and it was the high dump kick into their forward line. So we were very intent, as Macca said, being physical and at the body, and part of that is to get those high dump kicks going in forward because our backs read it so well. So it wasn't just Lever doing intercepts, it was Kelly. We had D-Mac going back to cover for Smith, and he played a fabulous game.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with either of those things.
Our wings going back, as we've talked about before. It's very much, you're watching this, and it was about halfway through the first quarter, I felt very comfortable with the way we were playing. And that was like, yeah, we got them.
Yeah, I don't disagree with either of those observations. I felt like we were using the ball out of congestion better than they were, and whilst the clearance numbers were fairly even, I felt like we were more effective out of clearances than they were. As you pointed out, Nikki, they tended to have to go back a little bit. Their kicks were more hat kicks. We tended to handball a little bit more out of congestion and free an outside runner-up who was then able to move the ball more effectively.
And free an outside runner-up who was forward of it. We weren't going back, whereas often we used to go back and then around.
Yeah.
We were going forward because we know they don't chase.
Yeah, so I just felt like it was the way in which we moved the ball and the way in which once we had field position, we were able to structure up behind the ball to not allow them to then get us on the turnover. And it really reflects, and I hate to invoke the heat map gods here, but if you have a look at the at where the game was played, in the first quarter it was played very much in the middle of the ground and a little bit across our half back line. And similarly in the second quarter, very much just defense side of centre was where all the ball was, and that was us basically moving up behind our forward entries and just basically compressing the ground so that GWS were really not able to effectively turn defence into attack very often. And then when you look at the second half, and I'll talk about this a little bit longer in the second half, because one of the reasons I reckon these stats are so close is because my observation was that in the second half we just shut up shop. We played a different style of game. We slowed the game right down. We structured up very, very defensively. I don't feel like we were sitting on the lead so much, but I felt like we were playing very clever football in that we were taking as much time off the clock as we possibly could, and we were making it as hard as possible for GWS to score. And that's reflected in where the play was in the third and fourth quarter. And again, if you look in the heat map, in the third quarter, it was very much on the half back line, and in the last quarter, it was very much actually more towards the full back line. So we were quite happy to absorb pressure in the second half, knowing that we had not only a lead, but I think that we actually had their measure, to be honest. And I felt like the game was over at half time, and despite GWS kicking the first three goals in the third quarter, we were able to answer fairly quickly and then go into that defensive mode. And I thought it was very, very smart and probably contributes to the evening up of the stats.
Yeah.
Their little run on was umpiring assisted, not so much their own good work. There were a couple, the two of their goals were some interesting decisions.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, we got a couple as well. I think the umpires were pretty decent, but I just feel
one
like...
One of them.
I
every team has its own, and They did have a little burst there, and whatever the reasons be. And that's why I think you're right there, Phoenix, that the coaching panel decided we'll just slow this down a little bit and just stop that run, and then we'll just get ourselves on top again.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we do particularly well in wet weather football is that we don't overcommit. How many times did we see GWS spilling the ball, and we were there to mop up, basically? And what I really like is the way we play wet weather football, in that we don't all just pile into the contest, and we have two or three outliers there, and as soon as a fumble is made or an opponent overruns the ball, that we're right there to pick it up. And again, it's clever football. You know, you're taught to go first for the ball and all the rest of it, but as we all know, in wet weather football, sometimes the first guy there isn't the one in the best position. And we just play very smart football in the wet.
I heard one very astute comment by a commentator during the weekend, and normally you hear some very idiotic ones, but this one was very, very clever. And it pointed out that when we're going forward and there's a loose man in defence for the opposition, and there are no obvious easy leads for us, we kick the ball high as a dump kick on the top of the head of the loose man, so the pack will come and jump over the top of him and take him out of play. So I thought that's a very... And actually, I watched after that, and we were doing that constantly, so I think it's a very clever move.
And that's Pavlet-Schumann, that observation. For me, going back to that wet weather part, Phoenix, it was so obvious in the first half that whenever GWS were kicking it forward, the players getting on the 45 in front of the GWS forwards were our backs and our midfielders coming down to rove off of it. But what I also liked was when we were kicking forward, it was very obvious from Tex and from Jenkins in particular, they were tapping the ball straight down.
Yeah.
They weren't trying to mark.
Yeah, you did
right. It
was
a tap straight down.
Yep. There's a few people criticising JJ, and we'll get to individuals in a moment, but as a general comment, I thought he actually played really well and competed very hard. And
he did.
You know, you're right. It wasn't a night for, you know, strong contested marks. And JJ's not renowned for that anyway, but I thought he contested well in 50-50 situations and did try and put the ball to the foot of the pack more often than not. And I thought he played it right. It's an interesting game, isn't it? Because for two teams that had similar number of disposals and looks at it, you know, we were 8-1 at halftime. Game over, really. That's first playing fourth, and GWS really never looked in it. And their good players did play reasonably well. So, and that was almost their strongest team. So I not many excuses for GWS. I just feel that they were outplayed by a better organised team.
Yeah, because you're right, their good players did play well. We have a look at Cadiglione, Kelly, Ward, and Scully, the midfield. They all played pretty well. But there were some other good players that were hurled. But that, in other words, they got a fair bit of drive from their midfield, but I thought... we actually won the battle of the midfield marginally, in my opinion.
I'd say a bit more than marginally. Because the delivery our midfielders were giving was superior.
Correct.
Yeah, I felt like we were more efficient in the midfield. Again, we'll go through individuals in a minute, but I felt like we played more as a team, as a midfield group, whereas... And I think this is a downfall of GWS, and it's a criticism of Cameron's coaching is that he doesn't have him playing cohesively.
I'm not sure that Cameron's in all that good a coach, to be quite honest. Look, he's got a team of thoroughbreds there in terms of what they've paid for many of them. There's heaps of top 10 draft picks there, and you would have thought that, I mean, Rendell's prediction of they'll end up taking the premiership year after year, you would have thought that eventually that would come to pass and that they would be very difficult to beat for premierships because of that. But To me, they just don't seem to achieve what they should be achieving.
Well, I made a comment on... Sorry, Nikki, go on.
I was just going to say, I think if there was a... Cameron's been very good at getting them together to band together to an extent, and he's a very good teaching coach, from what I've heard from within that club. He just can't take that next step. So if they had a better coach in terms of taking that next step and had greater tactical nous, then I think Rendell might have been right.
I don't know whether it's that, Nikki. I think it's actually a bit of a comment on their recruiting. They've recruited so much talent that they don't actually have any workhorses. And I made this comment on, I don't know, Thursday or Friday. They don't have enough grunt players. They need two or three blokes that are just workhorses, because at the moment you've got talented guys having to go in and get their own ball, and then they're not the type of players to do that. You know, imagine them with a Matt Crouch or a Hugh Greenwood or a, you know, someone of that ilk that could get in and under and dig the ball out like a Zach Merritt or someone like that. You know, someone like that.
Like a Riley Knight. Like a Riley Knight is a very good example.
Just a workhorse or two, Macca, yeah, to complement all that talent. I think their selection was poor. I don't know why they went in with what effectively turned into four talls, Lobb and Himmelberg, along with Patton and Cameron. I just don't understand that selection at all. I think in retrospect, they could have done with Stevie J up forward to try and jag a couple, notwithstanding that I reckon he is done. But, yeah, look, I just felt like the selection was wrong. I feel like they rely too much on individuals, and I don't think their balance is quite right. I think they need a couple of hard nuts to complement their talent. And if I was them, I'd be running Toby Green more often in the middle, because he is one of those grunt players.
Yeah, but he's so good at in the forward line too. You know, you really need two of him. But they've got one real grunt player on the ball, and that's Callan Ward. He goes in very hard. But you're quite right about the rest of the team is basically very skillful players and quite classy players, but they're not, as you say, grunt players, and not ones that go in there and prepared to die to get the ball. And I think, you know, to me, the epitome of a grunt player is Riley Knight. I you know, they've often said he's, you know, got a head as hard as a cat. Well, you know, he really has. He goes in, he gets some nice old blows, but he just keeps going in there and hunting it. I loved his game.
Anyway, let's look at some individuals, because there's a lot to talk about. And on Thursday night, and probably on Tuesday night as well, I can't remember back that far, a lot of comment made that would have been Thursday night, in the absence of Wednesday night it was. I'll get it right in a minute. In the absence of Sloaney, there were a couple of blokes that needed to stand up, and Richie Douglas was one and Brad Crouch was another, and by God, they stood up all right. Richie Douglas had a fantastic game, I thought. 15 kicks, 5 handballs for 20 touches. But I just felt his value around the ground and around the stoppages was fantastic. 5 tackles, 3 inside 50s, 7 clearances, 4 rebound 50s, 10 contested possessions. Disposal efficiency down a little bit, but 5 stoppage clearances as well. I just felt like he provided a cool head in close.
He did, and he got a couple of goals under real pressure too. So, that's the sort of player they don't have. And Richard Douglas, he's had a really good season, in my opinion.
Yeah.
He has. He's gotten back to that form that we'd seen a couple of years ago that he's then kind of petered off, but he's pulled it back up again. One of the things... I'm trying to remember which player after the game said it was one of the other ones, talked about that he, in the absence of Sloan, he was providing a lot more leadership as well. That was part of his role.
Game and high pressure acts too, 28 pressure acts, which was a game high. You know, just to epitomise his commitment to the contest.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And Nicky's point about the leadership factor, you could see him yakking away all night. So, no, well done, Richie Douglas.
Yeah, very good. Brad Crouch as well, I thought, really stood up. And he was the one I was probably most worried about, to be honest with you. 27 disposals, 16 and 11, which is so pleasing because Brad can tend to be a bit handball happy, but 16 kicks out of that 27. Took 4 marks, kicked a goal, a nice goal, 2 on the run, 8 tackles, 11 inside 50s, 3 clearances, 10 contested possessions, went at nearly 78% disposal efficiency. I just felt like it was a bit of a coming-of-age game for Brad in a big game.
Yeah, and I tell you what, a tough. He's just getting... I mean, he's always been a tough player, and then the Crouches, I like that, but... Gee, I thought he played a beauty, but he also got he won some hard balls and smashed his way through. And just to throw a question at you, Phoenix, who, if you had a choice, who would you take out of Brad Crouch and Josh Kelly?
Oh, look, different players, Macca. Can
I know
have,
that.
Can I have both?
You'd love to have both.
Both would be good.
I mean, Josh Kelly had a pretty good game for them. 33 touches, 7 tackles, 7 inside 50s, 12 contested possessions, you know, 6 score involvements. Look, a different player, to be honest.
No, but the point I'm making is that it isn't a clear-cut answer. In other words, Brad Crouch is really becoming a very, very valuable player up in the highest order.
Almost definitely.
Just watching him, and particularly that smother he did and that little burst of speed. And it was those little hints we've kind of had from him that this is the that he can go up a level. He went up a level overall that whole game. But still watching him knowing he's got further to go. And hilariously, I was listening to Triple M. And they were talking on Friday night on the way home, and Chris Judd comes out with talking about our midfield and how we smashed GWS, but our midfield's as slow as treacle because you've got the Crouch brothers, and like Matt's really slow and Brad's not quick. And I felt like going, he used to be danger in sprints, so yeah, I'd hate to see him actually be fast.
Yeah, I heard that comment, Chris Judd is a commentator, he's useless.
Oh, I think Juddy's all right when he's not pumping up his own tyres, which he seems to have turned into a bit of a brand-defining thing for him, which is a shame because when he first came on the commentary scene, I thought Juddy had some really good things to say, but now it's all about Judge Juddy and pumping up the Judd brand, and it's all just turned into a bit of a wank. Anyway, Matty Crouch as well, 31 disposals, team high. 15 kicks, 16 handballs, 3 marks, 7 tackles as well, 4 inside 50s, 7 clearances, if you don't mind, 14 contested, so he was inside a bit more than usual, probably in the absence of Rory, 6 clearances around the stoppage and 5 score involvements. The Crouch boys combined for, what's that, about 950 metres gained as well, just an excellent effort by Matt.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Matty Crouch is that some weeks ago and earlier in the season, I used to say, you know, he's the next Matty Prittis. But I'll have to say, the way he's been playing the last few weeks, he's better than that. He's playing more like Sam Mitchell. He just seems to have that time to spot that little pass or that little handball that the average player wouldn't see. Would you agree with that comment? Because that's what you remind him of. He played very much like Mitchell plays.
I've been calling him Mitchell for weeks, Macca.
You have. Well, I knew I'd get you your vote.
I've been agreeing with Phoenix that he's very Mitchell-like. Just that waltz he did through those couple little sidesteps, and he when we had that ended up with Dougie's little goal that stopped their run. He just had no right to waltz through them. The GWS midfielders are just going, what? Where'd he go? And the thing is, he's done that, and he's looking at the goals, and then he's actually seen Dougie outside. Oh, I'll just give him the handle. He just made the right decisions.
I think what we're seeing with Matt now is that we've gone from a player that we feel could make the level to a player who now knows he's at the level. I think, you know, the recognition of the All-Australian selection wouldn't have done him any harm, but I think over the course of the season we've seen his confidence grow, and it's not an arrogance, it's just an understanding and a recognition that he now belongs at the level and he can actually start controlling games. And I felt like he did control the game in the middle. He is a bit of a general for us, which is why I've compared him to Mitchell so much, because I think over the course of the next 5 years or so, that's the kind of player that he's going to be for us. He's going to be the player that can control tempo, can distribute the ball, and is actually starting to make some really good decisions by foot as well, which was probably the last little piece of the puzzle for Matt. So onwards and upwards for him, and you know, let's hope that we get good long service from both the Crouch boys.
Well, I heard Brad talking, and Brad said he loved the club, and he said he wants. I've heard Brad say he wants to spend his whole career with the Crows.
Yeah, Jake Lever said that too. he did.
Yeah, but the Crouch boys are very different beasts than Lever.
Well, yeah. Look, I thought Luke Brown was excellent at fullback. Had the hardest job, I think, of the night, actually, on Toby Green. And whilst Toby Green got a little bit of the ball, he certainly didn't hit the scoreboard, which is where the worry was. And I think Toby got most of his ball when he moved up the guts a bit.
We were allowing him to do that.
Yeah.
Also, a couple of times, Led was on him. There is confidence in that if the switch hasn't quite happened and we can't do it yet, you stay on him and I'll switch when we've got time. Yeah. And I like that from our defence.
Yeah, Lukey Brown got 20 disposals himself, 12 and 8, laid 3 tackles, 7 rebound 50s, 8 contested posies, and importantly, out of that fullback line, 420 metres gained. I thought it was just what we've come to expect from Luke, but it's such a contrast to last season when he was playing with that groin. He's moving freely, and I don't think there's a player that would enjoy playing on Luke Brown anymore.
I would hate to play him. He's that good. And the thing that gets me is that I don't know that he gets the public recognition throughout the AFL that he deserves, because, he doesn't even get a Guernsey when they start talking about half-back flankers for the All-Australian squad yet. It'd be very hard to find a half-back flanker that's tighter than him.
Because all they're interested in seeing is stats and flashy and running up the ground. That's their idea of a halfback flanker. We can blame McLeod for that, because that's where it all started from. But yes, you're right. He is a defender. He does his job. And I said it before that Hayden Ballantyne has actually come out and said he's the hardest to play on. And I'm pretty damn sure he wouldn't be the only small forward in the AFL that would say that.
Well, I can't argue with Nicky. As I said, if I was to play on anybody in that outside in defence, I'd hate to play on him.
Yeah, just one of those blokes that would piss you off. Look, and when you look through the rest of our individual stats, the numbers aren't high. I mean, after Luke Brown, it goes into the teens. McKay with 19, who I thought had an excellent game, 5 marks, 4 tackles. Really provided some run and carry on the outside and put his body on the line when he had to. That hit on, who was it, Dylan Scheel, I think?
On Scheel. It was brilliant.
Well, it was just a committed...
He protected the ball.
It was just a committed attack on the ball, and I felt he played well. Huey Greenwood, I felt, started really slowly. He was struggling with the conditions and the intensity early, I think. But he came good the further the game went on, and ended up with 13 kicks, 6 handballs, 3 marks, 7 tackles, 7 clearances, 17 contested possessions, if you don't mind. That's really his strength still. His clearance numbers around the stoppage were excellent. His score involvement, 7 score involvements. I felt like he worked into the game. His efficiency was down and his ball handling was down early. But he's only going to be better for that run, and I think look out over the coming couple of matches, hopefully, to see him improve now that he's got the speed of the game in finals. Riley Knight, I felt, played like a bulldog, 10 and 7, 10 tackles, 4 inside 50s, 10 contested possessions, 4 score involvements. Riley Knight is a type of kid that goes when he needs to go, and he'll turn a 70-30 contest into a 50-50 contest.
Yeah, he's got grunt. You know, you talked about grunt before. This kid's got grunt in lumps. And, you know, he there are better footballers than him, but no, I don't know any footballer goes in harder or tries harder than him. And by doing that, he makes himself a very handy acquisition to the side.
He was really key, particularly around stoppages through the midfield in general play, that he was one of those that was just that little bit forward of the ball. So he was there to do his stopping job, and then he broke as soon as we got it. And there were a number of our forward entries were involving just stuff that he did.
Yeah, and as PJ Crows on the chat points out, and I agree, he's a finals player. He is not afraid of the big moments, and he will make something out of nothing. And I mentioned last week that's why he stays in the team. And, God, you get another 5 possessions out of him a game, he'd be a bloody champ. But doing all right. I felt like of the rest, Atkins on the outside with Cameron and Seedsman all had their moments. Cameron frustrating by foot, but good pressure, Axe.
Atkins actually had some really great defensive and hard body stuff that he did early on. There was this, a spoil at the start and a few other things. And it's not what we see from him regularly, but it's something that we've called that where he needs to improve on. And it was really nice to see in a final.
Yeah, I'm with you, Nikki. I gave him a tick and a pass. I thought that, he was in that dubious spot. Who was going to be the last player in? And in my opinion, he was the last player to make the 22, and on his previous form. And although he didn't get as many possessions as he perhaps has in the past, I thought I couldn't fault him. I didn't see any area where I thought I could criticise him for not putting in pressure or not putting his body on the line when he should.
Yep, I agree with all of that. Cameron, if he starts gaining more composure with ball in hand, he's gonna be very dangerous. He only went at 33% disposal efficiency, but those blistering runs through the corridor off half back at times are just mouth watering. If only he could finish them off.
All he has to do is to learn to balance. When he's running it so fast, it would be impossible to kick them. Yeah. Or properly, and the guns with the extra pace, they just slow down those last 2 strides before the kick.
Yeah, but I think, all right. So I'll put a question to you, Macca, and your microphone is fading in and out a little bit. But would you rather take Charlie Cameron's low disposal efficiency but high pressure over Wayne Miller's higher disposal efficiency but lower pressure?
No, I wouldn't, because I love those bursts of Charlie's, and they're absolutely exciting and exhilarating. And at times they come off and they just make, you get the miraculous goal either by him or through a teammate. And he is going to eventually get control of that. And I think he's just going to be a real gun.
So the answer was actually yes, not no.
Yes.
You said no, but it was actually yes. You'd rather Cameron. Is that right?
I said,
would you rather Cameron over Wayne Miller? And you said no, and then proceeded to tell us why you'd rather have Cameron.
Obviously, you heard it back to front. Cameron. Take him every time.
Yeah. What about you, Nick?
At the moment, yeah. With what they've both been showing, I mean, Wayne has, he's shown that he can.
Right, now Nikki's gone.
Can carry him. Oh, well, this is fun. I was just saying that we can carry Cameron in our forward line because of the rest of what we've got around them, and he can do those higher pressure acts. consistently, whereas Wayne can do it, but he doesn't do it consistently and he has to be reminded. And at the moment, he's just got to work on that. And we can't carry him in the midfield because of it. So definitely Charlie ahead of Wayne at the moment.
Yeah, Miller, I'll agree with Miller, that.
Miller is a bit of a puzzle at the moment because, and I know it's only his second year, so he's got a long way to go. But he is a man that's got...
Why are you guys dropping out?
And there goes Macca.
He doesn't provide enough. A bit pun?
You'll have to say that again because for some reason you guys are dropping out. There must be a problem with the mumble server, I think. Keep going.
Yeah, I am holding the key down all the time. Now what I was saying about Wayne Miller, he's got all the attributes, but he's got to get a little bit harder and he's got to do it more often. He does drop out of a game and then there are times you don't see him for quite a period of time. And with the actual talent he's got, he needs to develop so he becomes a gun player, not just a bit player.
Yeah, and without going on about
I
it too much,
because
we're actually talking about the final. But I think the reason why I would have Cameron in over Miller is simply because Cameron will cause a turnover, whereas Wayne won't. And whilst we'd all love better disposal efficiency from Charlie, I think the fact that in a high-pressure final we've got a guy that can cause a turnover and break lines at this stage is more valuable than what Wayne brings to the table. The jury, I guess, is still out on who becomes more valuable longer term, and I suggest that with Miller's skills, if he can develop a harder edge to his game and get involved more often, he'll become the more valuable player. But as it stands in this final series, I think Charlie's far more valuable.
Oh, today? Yeah, Charlie every time.
I was just about to say before that I watched a little bit of the trial game on Friday morning because I had the morning off, so I wandered down to Footy Park. And there was an instance of there was a stoppage. Miller was standing out the back to from behind the stoppage, which, of course, was heading towards the GWS goals. He was not goal side of his opponent. He's attacking mindset. So he's very like those GWS players because he is one of those highly talented juniors that have come through that hasn't had to do the defence because their skill level has been so much higher than the other juniors they're up against. And he had to be yelled at. And it was either Cheney or Otten who were yelling at him to get back, to mind his player. And as soon as he heard that, then he went behind the player. So it's not something that comes naturally to him. He's having to learn how to defend as an AFL player.
Yeah, I think it's all also about how they're used as youngsters. I mean, those kids, as they're coming through the junior system, they're usually the standout players. So the coach generally says, you know, you go off and get the ball and they don't need to be accountable. So, you know, must be a little bit different.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll move on from that conversation. But I felt like Charlie, despite making me throw the remote a couple of times, his defensive work and pressure acts were enough. Look, our half-back line was very, very solid. I thought Lever and Kelly were excellent across half-back. I thought Seedsman provided good moments when required and, thankfully, will be a good inclusion for the very, very unfortunate Brody Smith. I felt like Kyle Hardigan had his best game for quite some time. So I felt, as a unit, our back six worked really, really well.
And also, backing up what I was talking about before with our forwards, particularly Tex and Jenkins tapping the ball down, our backs didn't try to go for marks. They punched. There was a definite, clear message on the way we're playing in these conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Lever, he put one punch there. He said flying back into the stands. He was outstanding in that regard.
Well, I think he got a bit of a message after last week to stop trying to mark the bloody ball and do what you're there for, which is to punch. And I felt Jake played really well, actually. Only 15 touches, took the four marks, but I felt like him and Kelly, just along with Tails as the lockdown and Kyle Hardigan, on the big fella, I felt like they did a really, really good job, and that was one of the problems that GWS had, was trying to pierce our back six, and they just couldn't do it for the majority of the night. You know, I thought Tex played really well. Like you said, him and Jenkins both, I think, presented well. Tex, I'm just going to say that Tex must be really struggling with that toe because he's not kicking for goal how Tex Walker kicks for goal. So he's clearly got a problem with his toe because either that or he's just forgotten how to football.
I was just going to say, Nicky, with turf toe, it's very hard to kick the ball as you normally kick it, I would think, and because it's supposed to be very, very painful too. So, but I don't know. He sometimes kicks it okay. I don't know. I've never had turf toe, so I don't know what effect it does have.
Not kicking through it.
Yeah, it's the distance. So he's not trying to go for his normal distance, which is when you kick through it. So he was doing a lot of those shorter kicks. I think he was being managed through because we knew we had a double chance. And so it's like, well, don't try too hard. Don't put more pressure on it than it needs to be. Just do what you have to do.
Oh, no, I don't think you do that in a final, Nick. I mean, we obviously managed him out last week against West Coast. But once you're on the ground, you play. But he's clearly not right in the foot. But I felt like he presented quite well. And like we've been saying, he brought the ball to the ground, took a couple of nice grabs, contested grabs, which was good. The one that I was really pleased about up forward was Eddie Betts. He kicked the three goals, but he just looked menacing, but not ridiculous. Like he wasn't trying, like he went for that one mark, but he wasn't far off actually taking that mark. But apart from that, I just felt like it was a more solid game from Eddie.
I thought he terrorised him, quite frankly, because even when he didn't get the ball, there was many times that he was taking on one or two or three of them, and he either got the ball into a scrimmage or out of bounds. I thought he had an excellent game.
I loved when they showed his little, that ridiculous snap goal that he took from the stoppage. So you've got Shaw, he actually lined up as if he was a defender on Shaw. He had his back to the play. He was like, I'm going to stop you. And Shaw didn't know what to do. And he essentially stopped Shaw being able to get that ball out. GWS lost it because we made sure that they had to have him manned up on Eddie. So they lost the run from him. And Eddie was very conscious of making sure that Shaw had to man up on him. But just the look in his eyes, it was very steely determined. He was not going to let his opportunity slip to get to a prelim final.
No, you're quite right, Nicky. And he did, I picked that up, that he would always look for Shaw and run to Shaw.
Yeah, they made Shaw accountable, and that wouldn't have suited Heath very well at all, because I think they were trying to get Tomlinson on him, weren't they? But anyway, and the last guy I want to talk about is someone who's really unheralded, but I thought he had just had an excellent game, and that's Tom Lynch. 25 disposals, 15 kicks, 10 handballs, took 10 marks, kicked a goal, 4 tackles, 2 inside 50s, 1 rebound 50 as well, 13 contested possessions, when at 72% disposal efficiency, 6 score involvements. I just felt like it was Tom at his very best.
High in our best players. He was he plays that role, the link man, to perfection. And there's nobody else in the AFL that can play it as well as he can. And he was right on Thursday night. I thought he played a great game.
Pavlich did the votes on Fox, and he gave the 3 votes to Tom Lynch. Can we just say one other thing about Source's work?
Yeah, I was going to talk
about around the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
I made a special mention for that.
Yeah. Just finishing up on Tommy, I think the ground that he covers and the work that he does off the ball, and what I really liked about his game on Thursday night is that he didn't burn the ball by foot. He was very deliberate with his foot passing. He was not lazy. He often has a tendency to kick off balance or not get back off the mark far enough and then kick into the man or, you know, something like that. But he made some very good foot passes to some very dangerous positions, and I just felt like it was an excellent game from Tommy Lynch. And you're right, two blokes we needed to mention at the end. Sammy Jacobs, obviously playing under emotional duress, only had the 9 disposals, 8-1, took 2 marks, 4 tackles, 30 hit-outs, 4 inside 50s, 3 clearances, 8 contested possessions. But I just felt like he imposed himself on Mumford, and I didn't feel that Mumford had any impact on the game whatsoever, and I just felt like it was a tower of a game from Source.
Yeah, well, Mumford had the princely tally of 2 handballs up to 3/4 time in terms of his contribution to apart from his ruck work. But I will say this for Mumford, he won a lot of respect out of me because he waited for Source to be finished being interviewed, and after having fought against him for the whole game and wrestling and pushing each other around, etc., etc., gave him an almighty hug and, you know, and some condolences, and I thought that was outstanding, and that's how you should be playing football.
It was really interesting in the first quarter because Source was trying his normal taps in centre bounces, which is that little bit out wider. Now, of course, Scheel was just taking the ball and going. From about halfway through that first quarter, he changed. He was tapping straight down to his feet. And if he couldn't do it, he was nullifying Mummy to make sure that Mummy was getting the taps, but they were going straight down. And we congested it in. That change up that we did created more chances for our midfield to get the ball how we want it and not allow them to exploit us with their pace, which they have.
Yeah, because what they like to do is get the ball to the outside and run. Whereas yep, what we tend to do is get the ball on the inside and dish and then run.
So a lot of people won't like this, but well done, Clark, for actually getting that change to occur.
Well, you're making a big assumption that it was Clark.
Well, they obviously, you would think that they would have pre-planned something. If they're doing this, then we change it to this way, or the call actually came during the game.
Well, Clarkie obviously didn't watch the tapes. He got it wrong in the first half.
Well, they didn't do it in the first half. It only lasted for about the first little bit. I mean, we tried to back ourselves in a bit. But I also loved that bit where he went on the bench and it just all kind of hit him. But the fact that Brody got up, saw his teammate, and hobbled himself over to give him a hug and some words. And Pikey actually pointed that out in the presser, that the care these blokes have for each other. And just on Smithers, he actually called Pods and Pikey the morning of his scans, so the next morning, and said, okay, I'm out. I want to keep helping. What can I do? I want to do some off-field stuff. I still want to be involved. I want to help us get there.
Yeah, well,
that's the type of players we have.
Yeah, but you wouldn't expect Smithers to do any different, really. You wouldn't expect him to stay away from the club at this late stage.
He was actually challenged when that particular, we know a number of players were challenged. He was actually challenged about the fact that his leadership he should be having and doing, he seemed to be more content to just enjoy being there and being the joker, and he had to step it up.
Yeah.
And he has been. And he also had to defend better.
Yeah.
He was told off.
I just want to make that comment that photo, was taken of what that situation you were talking about, Nikki, with. There's Smith, who's done his ACL, going to miss the rest of the finals. He's probably going to miss most of next year. And poor old Sources, you know, he's come off and the moment's hit him and he's thinking of his brother, and it brought tears to my eyes to see Smithy go up and put his arm around him and cuddle him, and I thought, that's outstanding. That is outstanding.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you'd be, I mean, yes, it is outstanding, but you expect nothing less, really, from a footy club. And it's such a shame for Brody because, as you rightly point out, Nicky, I reckon he had a rocket put under him about halfway through the season when we had all those man conversations, and he's been playing a far more aggressive brand of football since then, and was a really important part of our team. And nothing appeared illustrated that more than his ability to get that first goal and the way he was able to do that. And Paul Seedsman will be a good foil in Brodie's absence because they're not dissimilar, but Seed is going to have to play with a similar level of hardness because that's something that Brodie's brought to his game in the second half of the season. And I can't think of a less worthy recipient of an ACL. Not that anyone deserves it, but Brodie Smith has worked his guts out for a long time, come back from bad concussions in, 2015, and it's just such a shame that he's going to miss this assault on a flag. And, you know, good on him for getting up and getting involved and all the rest of it, but by God, I reckon it'll be hollow for him.
Yeah, no doubt about that, and you are right. Seeds is a very adequate replacement, but he will have to add a little bit of hardness to his game.
No, he doesn't, Macca. No, he doesn't. He's already got it. If you've been watching him in the SNFL since he's come back, and also when he started playing for us, he's got it. He's got that.
Nicky, he may well have. He's playing with the big boys now, not SAFL, and he's going to have to do that all the time at this level.
He did on the weekend.
He did, and that's my point. You're going to have to do that every time.
Every time he's played for us in the AFL, he's done that. I just wish people would actually stop on this, that, oh, he's going to have to do it more. He's done it every single time he's suited up for us.
There's been a couple of times he hasn't.
He has in general, Nicky, but there's been a couple of times he hasn't.
Anyway, let's not get caught up on that. I think obviously Rory comes in for Smithers next week. Seedsman stays in. I don't see any other unforced changes, really. I felt like we put our best team on the park, apart from Sloaney, and the team got the job done pretty comfortably. And now we sit back and watch the semi-finalists beat the hell out of each other next week.
Yep. Can I just say one thing? I missed on saying about Hardigan. I always give him a bloody hard time when he makes errors, and I didn't see him make any errors on the weekend. I thought he played an outstanding game and one of our leading defenders, and well done, Hardigan. Well, top stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I felt, like I said before, I think it was his best game for a while, and he looked rock solid.
No brain fades at all.
No, not that I saw. Look, anyway, guys, I reckon that pretty much does it. Just quickly on the SANFL, Sturt got up over a pretty gallant Centrals.
you had to say that, didn't you?
By 7 points. So they will meet the Eagles, who lost to Port in pretty convincing fashion in the prelim. And go you good thing, Double Blues, because I reckon we might just get up over the Maggies and the GF if we get there. Any last thoughts, guys, before we wind it up?
No, I just think that's it.
He thinks nothing.
No, that's it, Macca, you reckon?
Good night.
Are you getting put off by the background music that I'm playing? Keep talking, yeah. We're not done yet.
Okay. No.
You're a bugger.
What?
We're not allowed to talk through the background music. You tell us off.
No, this is the winding up music, not the ending music. It's the winding up music.
Which sounds like the ending music.
Yes. Well, I look forward to when we play Sydney. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I reckon it'll be Sydney too. And I reckon that'll just about be the grand final.
Yeah, it should be an epic game.
Anyway, we'll leave it there. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at AFL Crowcast. If you're listening to us on iTunes, you can leave us a review and some nice little stars. And we will be back on Tuesday night for Tuesday Night Live with tons to talk about.
Cop Wombles galore,
absolutely. And the Crowbar Boys will have their episode uploaded, I would suspect, within the next 12 hours or so, for their look at the game as well. So until Tuesday night, guys, I will bid you farewell and see you then.
Good night, all.
Night.